Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've all heard the drumbeat for years. Iran is developing nukes, and the military option is on the table. U.S. saber-rattling has been in the backseat. Israel's in the front. But what if it actually happened? If diplomacy was ditched and the bombers were already in the air or had already dropped their bombs? The strategic set has been wargaming deep in that scenario. It's not a pretty picture. That doesn't mean it won't happen. This hour on Point, wargaming Iran. You can join the conversation. Does an attack look crazy to you or like it may be coming? With what effect? Do you have a peace game alternative that would work? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington are two analysts who took part in a quite substantial Iran war game in December. It was organized by the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Kenneth Pollack is director of the center and author of A Path Out of the Desert, A Grand Strategy for America in the Middle East. Ken Pollack, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks very much, Tom. It's great to be back.
And with Ken in the Brookings studio is Suzanne Maloney, an expert on Iran at the Saban Center and author of Iran's Long Reach, Iran as a Pivotal State in the Muslim World. Suzanne Maloney, welcome.
Thank you so much.
We'll hear later in this hour from a former Israeli general and national security advisor who took part in another game in Tel Aviv. But Ken, let me come first to you. And I guess before we even get into the war game itself, give us a sense. No doubt listeners, with all of our experience in recent years, will be wondering, you know, what was your agenda here? You were kind of famously for intervention in Iraq and then later sort of gave a big mea culpa about that. We know you to be a thoughtful observer out here. What's your agenda with these games, Ken?
Thanks, Tom. Well, we recognized exactly what you were talking about, that there is a lot of talk about an Israeli strike against Iran. There's a lot of concern about an Israeli strike against Iran. And while we all have our private thoughts about whether it should or shouldn't happen, we simply recognized that this might happen. And we wanted to take a long, hard look at what the fallout, pardon the pun, from such a strike might be, and how the United States ought to try to prepare itself ahead of time for such an outcome by using a crisis simulation to try to identify potential problems and potential opportunities.
War games aren't something most of us do every day. How do you set it up?
It's a very complex process. First, you've got to get the right people, and we were blessed with three superb teams, an outstanding American team composed of former American officials, many of whom had been in the very roles that they were playing during the game, a superb Israel team of American experts and people with very close ties to Israel, and also a superb Iran team of people with extensive knowledge of Iran.
Including your colleague Suzanne, who's there with you today.
Absolutely, at the front of the line. Then you've got to come up with a credible scenario. You've got to figure out how you get from where you are in real time to at some point in a hypothetical future where you can then immerse those different teams in a situation that looks realistic to them where they are confronted with some kind of a crisis. So what we did, just briefly to explain, was we set it about 4 months into the future, actually, believe it or not, in March 2010. The game, of course, took place in December of 2009. And we simply postulated that the UN talks had basically produced a resolution that was nothing more than a slap on the wrist to the Iranians. There was a widespread sense that the sanctions were not going to have any impact on the Iranian regime, that the international community had lost its will to deal with Iran, and what's more, that the Israelis had come across a unexpected windfall of intelligence. They captured an Iranian who they did not realize how important he was. It turned out that he had extensive knowledge of the Iranian program, about secret facilities that the Israelis had not known about beforehand, and that information was highly perishable. So it created a situation which the Israelis felt like they had an opportunity, but one that was fleeting.
When your three teams, U.S., Israeli, and Iranian, showed up for the war games, you had, in a way, a surprise attack already, a surprise for them.
Yeah. This was one of the important things that we wanted to model. Our assumption going in was that the Israelis, for a variety of different reasons, certainly weren't going to telegraph the strike to the Iranians, but it was likely that the United States wouldn't know about it either. And so going into the simulation, we had told the American and Iranian teams that this would be a simulation about a potential strike, but it would start during a crisis phase. We told the Israeli team, and what we actually did was we began the game with the strike. So the Americans and the Iranians walked into their rooms and were presented with mock intelligence reports generated by the game planners before we began of the actual Israeli strike.
A strike on Iran and its nuclear facilities had already happened. And what did that strike look like? How was that? I don't know how much detail you gave, but to help us visualize this, what did in your game that strike look like, with what immediate results?
We postulated that the Israelis had sent about 100 warplanes against Iran in a single wave of attacks directed at about 6 different major Iranian nuclear facilities, the key nodes in the Iranian nuclear program. And, you know, you can never know what the actual damage from such a strike will be. That's one of the things that it's very hard for a war game to tell you. That typically has to be an input into the game. Mm-hmm. And so after considering it, we decided to actually allow the Israelis to have the most successful strike that it was possible to imagine, something that was really at the far end of the probability spectrum and I think probably much more successful than the Israelis have any reason to expect. And we did that very purposely. We wanted to allow the Israelis to basically wipe out the Iranian nuclear program as best Israel could, mm-hmm. recognizing that Israel can do much less damage than, say, an American strike, because we wanted to test the question of what would be the outcome, how beneficial or harmful would it be for the United States, for Israel, and also for Iran, if you started out with the Israelis getting their fondest wishes, doing the absolute maximum damage to the Iranian nuclear program, probably far more damage than they could in reality expect to do.
So there the stage is set in the Savant Center war games before they even sit down, that is, at least the American and Iranian teams, and a hypothetical attack has taken place, 100 warplanes over Iran, Iran's nuclear program substantially hit. Suzanne Maloney, you were playing on the Iran team. What was your team's first response? How did you receive this? I don't know even what to attack.
Well, I think one of the first things to note is that news of the attack very quickly consolidated the Iranian regime. There were some efforts made to ensure that dissent and opposition activity was contained, but frankly, all of the opposition leaders immediately rallied behind the regime, and the problem of internal fracturing and the sort of regime splintering that we're seeing, at least on the margins over the past 8 or 9 months, was really solved for Tehran. This sort of an attack on the homeland was taken very much as an episode to bring the entire Islamic Republic together and to rally the people behind the regime.
So if move zero was the Israeli strike, move one for everybody in the game was 3 hours later, how did you imagine the first Iranian response? Was it to hunker down? Was it to strike back?
Strike back, absolutely. I think this was important both in terms of maintaining credibility at home and also ensuring that you had this kind of rallying effect on the population. But what was also clear throughout the course of the initial response, as well as over the course of the game itself, was that the Iranians anticipated that the U.S. primary impulse would be one of damage control and crisis management. And so for Team Iran, the incentive was there to strike back as hard as possible without doing anything that might draw Washington into the fight. And that's exactly what we sought to do. We sought to demonstrate to the Israelis that the destruction of some of the key elements of the nuclear program would not go unnoticed. We sought to use as many of our assets in the region. We also sought to strike back at some of American allies in the region, particularly the Saudi government, because the perception was there had either been tacit cooperation or explicit cooperation to enable the Israeli strike in terms of flyover rights.
We'll get the American response and the Israel second step, but what form, make it a little real for us, what did the counterstrike, the Iranian counterstrikes look like? Where, what?
We struck back using Hezbollah and rockets across Israel. We struck back at the Saudis in terms of targeting oil installations in the eastern province. And we actually unleashed terrorist allies in Europe in order to demonstrate that the reach of the regime was not simply limited to the Middle East.
And Ken Pollack, we just got a minute before the break, but the first reaction from Washington to the fact, the fait accompli of an Israeli strike on Iran?
Anger, frustration. The Americans were very unhappy that the Israelis had gone ahead and done something that the Americans felt that they had told the Israelis over and over again not to do. And the fact that the Israelis didn't tell them that they were going to do it made it even worse. But the American reaction was, effectively, you Israelis have made an absolute mess. You have opened Pandora's box, and now you're going to leave it up to us to close the box and clean up the mess.
And did the White House turn to the Pentagon and say, get ready to come in at Israel's side and join the fray, or not?
Obviously, there were a series of dilemmas that the American team faced, and one of them is exactly what you're getting at, which is that the Americans did feel very strongly that the United States needed to demonstrate its willingness to defend Israel, to support Israel against these Iranian attacks. They felt that was important for reassuring the Israelis and making sure that they didn't do anything more aggressive. But by the same token, they wanted desperately to dampen the conflict. They wanted to stop the Iranian retaliation, and they were very fearful that the two sides would continue retaliating and that this would escalate.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are wargaming Iran this hour and what one big exercise found about the fallout of an Israeli, a hypothetical Israeli first strike. The war games were carried out in December at the Saban Center in Washington. There has been wargaming going on around Iran all over the place, in Israel, and we'll hear from there later, at Harvard recently, no doubt in many military centers around the region. And the world. The whole issue is very much in the air. The White House has been pushing for a big diplomatic action and sanctions, but we don't know how far that's going to go. Vice President Biden and a whole lot of other top American defense officials have been very much in Israel and the region. Here's Biden in Israel on Monday talking about Iran and Israel and the United States.
We're determined to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. And we're working with many countries around the world to convince Tehran to meet its international obligations and cease and desist.
Cease and desist. But how far would people go? And with what signals from Israel? The Israeli Defense Minister, Ehud Barak, was in the U.S. recently, seeming to hint that when it comes to Iran, the U.S. and Israel are on the same page, even when they don't seem to be or may not even need to speak about an attack if Israel decides to launch it. Here he is in February at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
There is, of course, a certain difference in perspective and difference in judgment and difference in the internal clocks and difference in capabilities. And I don't think that there is a need to coordinate in this regard. There should be understanding, there should be exchange of views. We do not need to coordinate every step.
We do not need to coordinate everything. And in the Saban Center's war games, they didn't. Israel went ahead and struck before the games even began. Ken Pollack and Suzanne Maloney were in the games. They're with us now from Washington. Ken Pollack, can you take us here, I don't know, 3 hours or a day into this and elaborate on first the American response? We heard from Suzanne. Iran's response was to strike back on several fronts, including Israel and arenas where American soldiers are engaged. What about the Washington response? Take us further into it.
Sure. Well, as you can imagine, the American response was very much an in-depth conversation on a whole variety of issues. Again, we had a superb group of people, former senior American officials who had been through crises like these. They looked at a whole variety of different perspectives.
A lot of these Democratic former officials, I think, not Republican. You said in the Obama administration it wouldn't be realistic to have a Wolfowitz or a Rice sitting in the game.
That's right. We were looking at a game, again, set in March of 2010, and mm-hmm. So we were hoping to recreate a National Security Council that was more reflective of what the NSC would look like mm-hmm. in March 2010 as opposed to what it looked like in 2004 or 1996 or something like that. But in any event, I think you can break down the initial American response into two different approaches, one toward Israel, one toward Iran. With Israel, it was a combination of wanting to reassure Israel of America's commitment to the Israelis, a willingness to stand by them. Very quickly, the Americans did agree to start sending Patriot anti-aircraft batteries to Israel to help. The Iranians were lobbing ballistic missiles at the Iranians, and the Patriots have some capability to shoot down ballistic missiles. Uh-huh. They put Aegis-class cruisers into Israeli harbors, which can do the same thing. And this was all about reassuring the Israelis that the United States was not simply going to walk away from them. At the same time, though, the U.S. team made very clear to Israel right from the start in the first move of the game, which again is a few hours after the attack, uh-huh. that the United States wanted Israel to now sit on the sidelines. They did not want the Israelis to retaliate. They felt that any Israeli reaction to these various Iranian moves that Suzanne was talking about would simply make the situation worse.
Meaning missile strikes coming into Israel from southern Lebanon, no Israeli response. At least that's what Washington asked.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Rockets coming in from southern Lebanon, a few coming out of Gaza, and Iranian
Syria,
ballistic
even,
missiles.
Mm-hmm. Iranian, okay.
Yeah, nothing from Syria, but from Iran. From Hezbollah and from Hamas.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Toward the Iranians, the American approach was basically to go to the Iranians and to try to speak to them directly, but through a whole variety of sources, to convey the message to Tehran that first, the United States was not involved in the strike, the United States was not responsible for the strike, the United States wanted to stop the conflict as quickly as possible, that the United States had weighed in with the government of Israel and insisted that Israel not retaliate, and that the United States now stood ready to broker an armistice with the Iranians as well.
So it wasn't, we're piling on here at the Pentagon, we're coming in right behind the Israelis. On the contrary, it was, stand down, everybody, was the message from Washington.
Or let's, exactly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
exactly.
Okay. And take us right on. I'm sure people kind of want to get to you. This was over 8 days. We don't get to go by every tick-tock of 8 days here. How did it play out?
Well, I think actually Suzanne is probably the person we should turn to next, because the next big issue in the game was the question of how Iran was going to respond to those initial set of moves by the United States and by Israel. Israel had launched the strike. Mm-hmm. The Israelis did want to do a whole variety of other things. They actually came into the Americans and they said to the Americans, look, we've created an opportunity here. We've mm-hmm. done massive damage to the Iranian nuclear program, and this is now an opportunity to perhaps topple the regime, certainly to better contain Iran and prevent it from becoming a threat to regional stability. And the Israelis had a lot of different ideas. And the United States basically shut them down and said, we don't want you getting any more involved. Your involvement is simply complicating the process. And so on the one hand, the Israelis mostly had to stand down. They did obviously start to mobilize their forces and begin to try to shoot down the incoming missiles and protect their population. But they were mostly willing, because the United States was so angry and so determined, the Israelis were willing, at least initially, to stay quiet, to take the hits, and to let the United States take the lead. Mm-hmm. And then the United States made this overture to Iran that effectively said, look, we don't want a war, we don't want to escalate, we're not trying to get involved in the war itself, we want everyone to stop shooting.
So, Suzanne, how did Iran read that and respond?
We read that overture as confirmation of the presumption that American interest was primarily one of mitigating the crisis rather than of joining the Israelis. And in fact, we didn't reciprocate. We didn't entertain the American overture. There was initial receptivity on the part of the individual to whom it was communicated. And when he came back and shared the fact that an American interlocutor had approached him, the entire team said, absolutely not. Under these circumstances, Iran would under no circumstances meet with an American official. We felt ourselves to be on the ascendant at this stage.
Even though your nuclear program was set back, what's the judgment, by years?
Exactly. The fact that the crown jewels of the nuclear program had been taken out actually meant that we felt less constrained by the possibility of further retaliation.
Because why? Because you didn't think it would come because that was set back and so it wasn't worth coming
We had less to lose, mm-hmm. and we had the entire nation really rallied behind us mm-hmm. And looking for retribution. And so it was seen as the American interest in trying to negotiate or trying to broker some sort of cessation to the crisis was seen as simply another opportunity to escalate on the part of Team Iran. And I think that that is, in fact, very consistent with the mindset and the perceptions and certainly the public rhetoric of the current array of officials in Iran.
Ken, we can come back to details, but take us to the bottom line. We have callers who want to come in here. We're going to go to Israel as well. By the time the dust settles, at least 8 days worth of strike and aftermath. Who's won what? Who's lost what? What was your bottom line in this war game on Iran?
Sure. Well, I think my perception, I think that of most people, is it's hard to say that there was any winner in the game. It seemed like, in fact, there were a lot of people who lost. The game ended after 8 days, and it's true that you could make a case that the Iranians had made some gains, and certainly the Israelis had those initial gains preserved. But had the game gone on for another move or two, another 4 or 8 days, mm-hmm. Where we left things was the United States was building up massively to move into the Persian Gulf in response to some very aggressive Iranian moves. And I think the United States was about to obliterate the Iranian Navy, air defense forces, and air forces.
Because the Straits of Hormuz and oil movement had been threatened.
Exactly, mm-hmm. because the Iranians had mined the Straits of Hormuz, and that had crossed the U.S. red line, that had pushed the United States from trying to take a neutral stance to one where it was moving to actively confront Iran. And so I think had the game gone on, Iran would have suffered grievously from that. On the Israeli side, as the game wore on, they faced a very significant dilemma. And the dilemma that they faced was that the rockets coming out of Lebanon and we got up to about 100 rockets a day with another half dozen missiles striking Haifa and Tel Aviv on mm-hmm. a daily basis, had driven a third of Israel's population into fallout shelters, into bomb shelters, and was causing hundreds of thousands of people to flee Haifa and Tel Aviv, and it basically brought the Israeli economy to a standstill. And under those circumstances, the Israelis were trying very hard to work with the Americans, but they finally went to the U.S. and said, look, we have to be able to go into Lebanon and to stop this. And the Americans finally agreed, and at some level that was a victory for the Israelis, but on the other hand, they were, as the game ended, about to launch a 48-hour air and special forces blitz into Lebanon, which, quite truthfully, the Israeli team knew was not going to be enough. And so they were already gearing up, already mobilizing their forces for a much bigger intervention into Lebanon.
So Iran ends up hit hard, but freer to act in many ways. Sounds like the U.S., if they're obliterating the Iranian Navy, they're kind of at war on a new yeah. front. And Israel's at war again in Lebanon. What's the bottom line from this? Does this say to everybody or somebody no to the military option? What does it say in your analysis?
Well, you always have to be very careful with these kind of crisis simulations. They're not reality. They are abstractions from reality. But what they do is they point out problems and opportunities. And what we saw coming out of this game were some very significant problems for all of the different actors involved, but in particular for the United States, which is the country that we were most concerned about, and that there was a real potential for American interests in the Middle East to be threatened in a whole variety of ways. But not coincidentally, as you're kind of pointing out, we also saw some very significant problems for the Israelis moving forward. And, you know, the Israelis have been concerned about the Iranian nuclear program for 8 years now, and for 8 years now there have been Israelis who have been threatening to strike, and they've so far not done so. And I think what this simulation did was it pointed out some of the reasons why Israel has not struck yet, because there is the potential for some very severe problems that Israel might face, in particular the possibility that Israel might have to go into Lebanon and or go into Gaza as a result of a strike, because Hezbollah and or Hamas begins to retaliate against them.
All right, there's a lot on the table. We have a lot of calls lined up. Larry in Aledo, Illinois, you're on the air, Larry.
Yes, I got several points as I've been sitting listening. Suzanne made up a good argument right from the beginning, is that the consequences of this taking out Iran's facilities, I don't think people quite get the mindset that goes into the Islamic nations of how they'll rally around each other. You'll have a field day for Hamas and Hezbollah to point fingers and just to show the evils of the Zionists, and how the United States will become the public enemy number two to them also, because of their perception of how we'll do anything for Israel. As I have to tell you, as much as I hate to see Iran get these weapons, in reality, it's not actually our place to. I mean, we have them. France has them. Pakistan, other nations have them.
Israel has
them. So, from the basic argument, is that yes, but I would make it very clear. Go to the United Nations or whatever, and make it very clear to Iran that, look, if you want to acquire nuclear weapons, you're a sovereign nation, and we really tell you that, but the consequences of you using them or threatening Israel, no more warnings, no more, this is what is going to happen if you do that, and make it unpalatable for them.
Larry, we've got it. Let me put it to Suzanne. Suzanne, what about the Islamic world reaction? Did you get into that in the war game here? Larry sees kind of united front emerging. How did it play out in the games?
Well, I think there are two dimensions to speak to. One is that of Iranian allies or proxies in the region like Hamas and Hezbollah, which have operational relationships with Tehran and are to some extent, if not beholden, at least receptive to the entreaties of the Islamic government. I don't think we were looking more widely to, popular uprisings across the Muslim world, although we recognize that there would be some of that. There would certainly be a reaction within Saudi Arabia, and we were hoping to exacerbate that by appealing particularly to the Shia minority there, with which we have religious ties and other longstanding relationships, to put additional pressure on the Saudi regime. But largely, I think there was a recognition that it was the domestic impact within Iran which was so powerful and so important in forming the mindset and the reactions of the leadership.
Let's get a call right here from Michael. Oh, I'm sorry, we just lost him. Let's go to Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
The nightmare scenario for the United States is that a Middle Eastern regime will acquire nuclear weapons and be aggressive and expansionistic. The problem is that there already is such a regime in the Middle East, and it's Israel. They've had nuclear weapons for years. They have been militaristic and aggressive. They launched a preemptive strike against Iraq years ago. They've been bombing the Palestinian settlements with regularity.
They've also been attacked.
Just this week, Vice President Biden went there to encourage peace talks and was greeted with a back of the hand, an announcement that there are going to be 1,600 new settlements in East Jerusalem.
What does it say to you, Mark? We just got a minute before the break about Iran, the nukes, and what can or should happen.
The problem I have with this scenario is that we're doing it with one hand behind our back. It's kabuki theater, because nowhere in this analysis have they talked about putting pressure on Israel up front by removing the support. In fact, threatening to remove the support in view of this expansion or in view of this potential attack. The premise is always that the United States will always stand by Israel, defend Israel, give Patriot missiles to Israel, and be the big brother to make sure that Israel, no matter who they attack in the neighborhood, can count on the United States to fight their battle.
Mark, we've got the perspective. Let me put it to Ken Pollack. Ken, we just got half a minute before the break. What do you say?
Mark's absolutely right. The game was absolutely not about the fundamental nature of the U.S.-Israeli relationship, which is something that you might be able to model and do a crisis simulation, but would be difficult. What we wanted to look at was the very specific and potentially, very real-world problem of what happens if we get an Israeli strike against Iran. How does the United States deal with it? What is the potential fallout for all of the different sides?
You say that the U.S. did not know in advance, but didn't these 100 Israeli warplanes in your scenario have to fly over Iraq or somewhere where there are U.S. troops? And
we sent him over Saudi Arabia, and that's one of the reasons that the Americans did eventually find out about it. American warships in the Persian Gulf started seeing these planes traveling at very low altitudes.
Hard to miss 100 warplanes. Ken Pollack, I'm sorry, we have to take a break right here. We'll hear a voice from Israel when we return. Ken Pollack, Suzanne Maloney, please stand by in Washington. We are wargaming Iran. Listeners, what do you hear? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This hour we are wargaming Iran, looking at what one big exercise found about the fallout of an Israeli First Strike. Kenneth Pollack and Suzanne Maloney have joined us from the Saban Center in Washington. Their scenario playing out an eight-day attack and responses in December is now part of the public record, and we're looking at it in this hour. We're joined right now from Tel Aviv by Giora Eiland, retired Major General in the Israeli Army, now Senior Research Fellow at Israel's INSS Institute in Tel Aviv. He was Israel's National Security Advisor, focusing on, among other things, the Iranian nuclear program. He took part in a different war game around this scenario late last year in Tel Aviv. General Eiland, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. The war game that we had in Tel Aviv was not about a possible Israeli attack, but it was about the prospect of success of an American-Iranian negotiation, something that began in a much more optimistic way 4 or 5 months ago. And it is less relevant to our discussion, if I understand it correctly. So maybe the first thing that has to be emphasized, specifically after the response of the last person who spoke on the show,
yes,
is that nuclear weapons in Iran is not exactly or not only an Israeli concern. It is a real concern to the region, and there are many, many reasons for that, not only the beginning of a nuclear race in the Middle East, but also just take, for example, what might happen in Saudi Arabia if Iran has a nuclear weapons. There is a minority of about 20% of Shias in Saudi Arabia that for the time being are quite suppressed by the regime. And what happens if Iran has a nuclear weapons and this 20% will try to ask for their equal share in the wealth of the country? It might bring to instability of the major oil producer in the world. And not to mention that if Iran has a nuclear weapon, then any conflict in the Middle East, whether Israel is involved or is not involved, will take place under Iranian nuclear umbrella. So the instability to the region, which is already a very sensitive area, might increase. So these kind of considerations are not necessarily only Israeli considerations.
Giora Eiland, as I understand it, in your war game, which, as you say, was looking at a kind of pre-war scenario, and you were playing in this game Benjamin Netanyahu, but Israel could not get Obama to support military action, and as the reports I've read describe the conclusion, your conclusion as being that Israel could not afford to go it alone. Is that accurate?
In a way, but as I said, this was not the main issue of the war game. But if we talk about the a possibility of an Israeli strike, then if you want to understand the Israeli consideration, then I will say the following. First, it depends on the scenario. In other words, if, surprisingly, there is an American-Iranian deal, of course, Israel cannot attack even if we are not satisfied with this possible deal. Number two, if the United States manages to create a very effective international economic and political pressure against Iran, then, of course, Israel cannot do anything that might be perceived as an attempt to undermine this international attempt. The only scenario that might make an Israeli operation, a military operation, reasonable is more or less the continuation of the current situation where there is no real negotiation between the West and Iran. Iran continues to enrich uranium, and the United States, for this time being, fails to create an effective isolation of Iran. So first, we have to be in the right scenario, which is a bad scenario, but this scenario is a precondition for any possible Israeli attack. Then we go to the second point, and this is what are the chances to achieve a real significant achievement if we really conduct such an attack. And of course, there are a lot of military and professional questions, which are, first, do we have enough intelligence? Number two, can we really send enough sorties to attack these sites? Number three, do we have the right ammunition that can penetrate all the bunkers and tunnels in which the Iranians keep some of their important material? And number four, suppose we can do all these things in a positive way, is it going to achieve a significant delay in the Iranian project or less than that? Mm-hmm. So this is the professional questions, and the answers are not very clear. And here we come to maybe the most important point that was emphasized by the previous speakers, mm-hmm. and this is what would be the United States' response for an Israeli attack. And I would carefully say the following. If the United States say in the very clear and explicit way that Israel should not attack Iran, then Israel will not be able to attack Iran. Now, it is very different from other events in the region that are primarily Israeli business. So sometimes we can attack in Lebanon, or attack in Gaza. Even if the United States is not happy with this kind of attacks, it is perceived to be more an Israeli problem rather than the American problem. But if we do something in the Gulf, and as Susan said correctly, one of the Iranian response would be to attack some of the oil fields in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and other places, then most of the consequences are relevant to the American interest much more than to the Israeli ones.
So is it clear to you as we speak today that the U.S. is giving the signal to Israel, no, do not attack? Is that a clear signal as you describe?
I'm not sure that this kind of very clear sign, don't attack whatsoever, has been given. But, you know, when in diplomacy there are different kind of no. You can say no in an implicit way. You can do it in an explicit way. You can say yes, but you can say yes, but then depends on the results of the attack. All that I describe now is important, but what I'm trying to emphasize is that if the United States says in a very clear way, don't even think of attacking Iran, then Israel will not be able to do it, first because of the strategic reasons, and the second, there might be some operational problems because, as it was mentioned before, there are American forces in Iraq and in the Gulf, and we, of course, will not be able to do something without any kind of, at least, last-moment coordination with these forces.
Suzanne Maloney, I wish we had Tehran on the line here right now, as well as Tel Aviv, but do you think, as that Iran sees an attack now, given, you know, I'm sure they're doing their own war gaming, do you think they see it as a real possibility?
I think there's almost a kind of split personality in Iran on the prospects and likelihood of some sort of military force to be used against the nuclear program. On the one hand, particularly among the hardliners, they do feel very much invulnerable as a result of U.S. Involvement on their borders and the variety of priorities, particularly as articulated by the Obama administration for improving American relations in the region and for dealing with the peace process and a wide variety of other issues. At the same time, this is Iran. It's a leadership that is very insular, that is to some extent paranoid for probably good reason, that has been attacked before and whose leaders are among those who served at the front during the Iran-Iraq conflict, and so feel very much as though at any time the world is aligned against them, and at any time they may be subject to yet another use of force against the country. So that you have this dichotomy that pervades the leadership thinking and to some extent plays out in their public rhetoric.
Let's go to Des Moines, Iowa, and Dave. Dave, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. So our military is stressed out. I don't foresee the scenario actually only taking 8 days, even if it was only a mopping up operation.
Sure, yeah. And they're not suggesting that. That's just as far as they went, but I take your point.
Right. Where would we get the troops? Would there be a draft?
Ken Pollack.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting question, actually, because something that we did here at the Saban Center last year was to look at 9 different U.S. options. And one of the things that we looked at was airstrikes, and basically for a whole variety of reasons, it's unclear that the airstrikes actually do the job, and you might actually, if you really wanted to do it right, you might have to go to an invasion, which because of how American troops are stretched thin might require something like a draft. What I'll say in this case, though, is that in the scenario we were looking at, all the United States was looking at doing was basically destroying Iranian air defense and naval assets, which was something that was well within the capabilities of the U.S. Air Force and the Navy to handle with the forces available to them. But if it's going to go beyond that, if we are looking at an American operation to try to take out the Iranian nuclear program by force, it may be that that air forces alone are not able to do the job permanently.
And that leaves the question of resources. Shalom in Newton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Shalom.
Yes, I'm here. I find it at least surprising, at most irresponsible, maybe scandalous, that another worst scenario maybe you're contemplating in the future but has not been done, namely, what happens if the installations of Iranian nuclear forces are not attacked? And let me give you just one quick scenario out of several, because the question what happens if they're not attacked is not being touched upon even. And one of the scenarios is, given Hillary Clinton's statement there will be devastating response after Iran attacks Israel, which both presidents said that even if 20 million Muslims will die, Israel has to be wiped off, what one of the things will happen, there will be simultaneous attack on Israel, United States. That's at least a scenario to be explored. Four missiles on Israel, Haifa, Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem. They have neutron bombs, so they don't destroy the temple, just the people, and Dimona. And four suitcase bombs on Washington, New York, Houston because of the oil, and Boston because of international.
Shalom, you've got a nightmare scenario. Let us look at it. Ken, what about if there's not an attack? And, of course, many people don't want one. What's that scenario look like? And I'm reading lately that, in a sense, that's what Washington has already come to as its conclusion. There won't be one. There'll be a kind of long, slow negotiation and maybe ultimately acceptance of it, at least in Washington.
Yeah, and of course, it's absolutely correct that you need to be thinking about what if we don't strike as well, because not taking action is an action. And the Iranians are clearly marching down a certain road, and if they're not knocked off that path, they may wind up at their destination, whatever it is. The problem is that we don't know what the future holds, and there's a great deal of debate about it. There are a lot of people who are very, very nervous about what an Iran with a nuclear weapon would be like. I will say that I am part of that camp. I think that it could be potentially very destabilizing, exactly the way that Giora suggested. That doesn't necessarily mean, though, that even if you believe that Iran with a nuclear weapon could add to the problems of the Middle East, that it necessarily means an apocalypse. And one of the big questions lying out there that none of us knows is what the Iranians would do once they had one. There's quite a bit of evidence that suggests that the Iranians might be more aggressive, but they wouldn't necessarily be insane. They wouldn't try to bring about Armageddon. And one of the big questions being debated in Washington today, and I think in Tel Aviv as well, in Jerusalem, is the question of whether a nuclear Iran can be deterred, the way that we deterred the Soviet Union throughout the Cold War, the way that we have deterred North Korea so far. If we're able to do so, then a Cold War with Iran might be dangerous, it might be frightening, it might be costly in some ways, but it wouldn't necessarily be apocalyptic. On the other hand, if Iran can't be deterred, well, then we're in a completely different world.
Yura Eiland, how do you look at this? Israel look at this? Is there a containment slash deterrence option here that you're prepared to live with long term?
For the time being, the Israeli official policy, and not only the official policy, I believe that this is a real policy, is not to let something like this, or not to let a question like this to be a relevant question, because it is not only that Iran is a different country than the Soviet Union. Speaking about Ahmadinejad, for example, he sees his legacy or his destination is to bring to the destruction of the State of Israel, so I'm not sure that we can count on his calculated considerations.
But Khrushchev banged his shoe on the podium at the UN and said, "We will bury you." It's not as if we haven't heard that language in history, even in nuclear history.
Yes, but it is very different because even if Iran does not take direct measures against Israel or against other countries in the region, it is clear that every conflict in the Middle East will be very different from the conflict that we experienced in the past, because the potential of use of nuclear weapons by Iran for the countries that they support might create a situation that is unbearable. For example, Hezbollah. Hezbollah for the past 3.5 years does not open a fire along the Israeli-Lebanese border because they are deterred. But if they feel that they have the Iranian nuclear weapons as something in their bag, they might be more ambitious. They might use their weapons then.
So yeah, I want to get one more call, if I may, sir, if you'll permit me, and I thank you. AJ in Brookline, Massachusetts. AJ, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I enjoy watching the program. I think there's one major issue here that's lacking. I don't hear any Iranians on the program or part of this war game.
AJ, I agree. That is an omission. They're trying to represent them, but so what do we do?
Well, I think we have to bring them into the mix. I think it's rather interesting that we are playing war games like this is a Hollywood movie.
No, we're not. No, we're, this is serious.
I understand that, but I you know, I think there's one issue that we have, we seem to skirt, and that is Israel has nuclear weapons, and to me and to others, they're acting like the tyrants of the Middle East.
Tyrants?
No one is dealing with that. I think if we can remove the nuclear weapons from Israel, perhaps Iran won't be an issue.
AJ, our time is short. Ken Pollack, what about it? Step way back and change the game. Change the game board in a different way, the serious game board, in that direction.
I mean, look, in Israel without nuclear weapons, it's almost impossible to predict. Let's remember that, you know, Israel does face very serious strategic threats. And, you know, what we've seen since Israel acquired nuclear weapons is that on a number of occasions we've been able to persuade them, and they've even decided among themselves not to take aggressive action because they felt like they could do so. In 1973, the October War, people were screaming that Israel had to act in a more aggressive fashion, and in fact Prime Minister Meir basically said, look, we can afford to do this. But, you know, I think that what we need to recognize is exactly that Israel does face very significant strategic threats. And so if what you'd like to do is eliminate all nuclear weapons from the Middle East, have a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East, the only way you're going to do that is to solve the strategic problems of the region.
The headline
we've seen in Europe elsewhere, that's the only way to do it.
The headline out of your games when it first came out was War Games Show How Attacking Iran Could Backfire. Is that still how you see it, Ken? A backfire?
Well, that wasn't my headline, first of all.
Understood.
And again, you know, what we did was we identified a number of very significant problems that could occur for the United States if this scenario were to occur. And I think that is a very valid point, something the United States needs to consider.
No kidding. Kenneth Pollack and Suzanne Maloney at the Saban Center in Washington, thank you. And General Gira Eiland in Tel Aviv, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.